is the Woodstock Public Library's podcast, sponsored by the Friends of the Woodstock Public Library. And I am Bailey.
And I'm Stephanie. We are here with Timothy David Ray, Chicago poet, playwright, performer, and poet in residence with the Poetry Center of Chicago. He is working with the Atrocious Poets, leading their writing workshop in April as part of their celebration of Gwendolyn Brooks.
So we were wondering, when did your love of poetry begin?
I was an early poet from the very beginning, so I think it's fair to say that poetry was sort of my first best language that I explored on my own. And it's interesting because I don't have a memory of anyone sort of coaching me or directing me in that direction as far as crafting poems. But I think I was drawn to it for the concise structure, probably initially as a lot of small children are because of the rhyme, and just began writing on my own. I think 7th or 8th grade was probably when I really began keeping, journals of poetry and creative writing.
Mm-hmm. So it was something that kind of came naturally to you.
It seemed to, yes. Yeah. Of course, we wouldn't say naturally. Poets would say from another realm.
So do you have a favorite poem or a favorite poet that you would like to tell us a little bit about?
I thought about that a lot. I brought up a poem that I always go back to, and it is Adrienne Rich's Diving into the Wreck. And I just remember that being a real important work that I revisited over and over again when I was in college. And I would just sort of read the text. I'd go up to the graduate stacks over that was very quiet and reading over and over over the work. And it's something that I sort of runs through my head continuously. I also really like the work of Richard Blanco, the Obama inauguration, so the inaugurative poet. And he's an engineer and a poet. And so I think it's interesting how he approaches the work with the eye of an engineer, with the eye of really crafting a poem that's something that's built. It's a poem is something that's made, right? So plays are wrought and they're not written, and poems, I would argue, are more sort of crafted. And he really looks at a poem and through that lens, and I just love what he comes up with. I think initially just the accessibility of Hughes's work inspired me, that it does not have to be complicated necessarily right away, like when we're looking at it on the page, that it can be and should be accessible to folks. And I think his work embodies that sort of desire to be accessible to people. And I'm really interested in sort of observing, which a lot of poets do, but sort of someone described it, David Hernandez, the poet, said, you're painting portraits with words, right? So you're sort of observing, and then you're creating people or landscapes through these poems that you've written. I really have to think about that. The artist doesn't always know what the artist is doing. He made that comment a few years ago before he passed away, unfortunately, but I didn't really understand what it meant. And now I understand what it means, and it seems like it would be easy to digest that statement.
Yeah.
But I think when you're in the throes of writing, it takes some time to step away and sort of recognize I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and this is the way it's being perceived.
Timothy, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now and a little bit about what inspires you?
I'm working on a collection of work, I think. I'm in the uptown neighborhood of Chicago. So a lot of it has to do with, observations of people and change. Yeah, like race, class, LGBT issues. But again, I think there's sort of like a wide sweeping to these ideas. So it's not always a person, but sometimes an idea that really intrigues me. And so I'll go after the idea. Right.
Instead of
sort of like the person themselves. In the monologues and plays, I think I'm more interested in the person themselves. But with these poems that are sort of these portraits and these landscapes, I'm interested in sort of the big idea, the idea of going west, right? The idea of traveling west, and the idea of being a black person, African-American person traveling west. So that idea intrigues me. So what do we find when we go west? Why do we go west? What's at the edge of things? So those are big ideas. Those are huge ideas and very American, right? And sort of the American lore. And so tapping into those things and then sort of turning them and keep on turning them and seeing what's exposed and the sort of looking at them again, sort of through a different lens.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you love about poetry education and the Poetry Center of Chicago?
Isaac Perlman was interviewed on a documentary, and he said, every opportunity I get to teach, I take it. and I loved what he was talking about. I think there's a passing on of information that happens with an artist and a student.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's invaluable to have an artist in a classroom. And these are formalized classrooms. Even if they're after school programs, they're pretty much in a formal setting. And so it's interesting to investigate what learning looks like outside of the textbook, right? You know, which might be really an archaic sort of form of learning. And so when we go into a classroom, and the Poetry Center is very generous in allowing the artist, the poet, to come up with their own curriculum and speak with the teacher about what they'd like to work on during a 20-week residency where the poet works with the students for about an hour. But there's so many poems to choose from in the world that it's a nice space to create a learning experience that is not formalized.
Mm-hmm.
So you're coming in and you're really asking for students to crack open their imagination, which with the onset of more and more technology is really a difficult task sometimes. And I think in America we have a very clear image of what work is, but we don't have such a great idea of what play is. And the older we get, the less we encourage creative play. Going in with a poem, which is really sort of an idea, I say to the students, it's a human idea, and it's masquerading as a poem, right? It's
mm-hmm.
masquerading as a sonnet or a villanelle or a minimalist imagist poem, right? But it's our human ideas that we're crafting is a different way to approach learning, right? And it kind of triggers different neurons to start firing. I've been with the Poetry Center for about 3 years now, and so I've been able to observe with some advanced classrooms and then some classrooms where you may have diverse learners or struggling readers and writers, that the same poem and the idea can work, right? You can use Shakespeare at the advanced class level, and then 2 hours later, you can teach the sonnet as well in a classroom that is not as advanced, right? And it's how you teach it, how you approach it, and then, of course, approaching it from the delight of the art form, right? So there's some technical things when we look at a Shakespearean sonnet, but I really focus on what's daily and what's doable. What can we do daily and what we can do that's doable in the classroom to create work? So I think a great analogy would be sort of how you paint with a palette and how you begin creating an artwork, a visual artwork, with various strokes. Sometimes you have a whole canvas that's full of paint. Some days you're just stroke by stroke, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way of approaching it that I really like, and I learn more and more as I go in, of course, how the students are learning, what the teachers want, and what work is being revealed. It's just amazing to me, always.
It's a great opportunity, like you said, with kids who have less and less creativity in their days, and it gets cut off younger and younger, it seems like. It's great that they are able to have this.
Yes. And it's getting a better rap now. We have, you know, poets that are sort of the millennial generation of poets who are coming out and getting more widely published. And so we have an increase in poetry readership, you may have heard. And there's a big article in The Atlantic, and Poetry Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts have been creating a program for the last 15 years called Poetry Out Loud, which is a poetry recitation contest for high school students. So I think it's chipping away at that sort of stigma that it's an elitist art form, that it's not accessible, that it's difficult, that it's hard, and that, you know, we might as well just close the book on it, that it's something that we can do and is part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not a poetry expert, but wasn't Gwendolyn Brooks also one of those individuals who wrote a lot about her environment and about the things she saw going on around her?
That is correct. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Gwendolyn Brooks said, and I agree with her, that, and I'm paraphrasing here, so please forgive, that, you know, a regular person, if you will, you know, walks by a rose and says, oh, that's a rose and that's pretty. And the poet looks at the rose and then sort of walks backwards and really takes a look at it and really examines what's going on with this thing and begins asking a lot of questions. And I think that's a great place to start. I think we might even say that to be a teacher and a workshop leader or a teacher of the arts might be a wonderful place to come from where I'm not sure what the answers are, right? I don't know all the answers. And I think that's an instance in that vein that you sort of approached her own work, and it was very investigative work as well, based on in the Chicago community and what was happening in the 70s and the 60s, and again looking what is around her, right, to come up with work. One of the books came to DeKalb, Illinois, where I was raised, and she was giving a reading during the day at Northern Illinois University, and then a workshop during the day, and then a reading at night. And so I remember my mother taking me to the workshop portion. I was sitting there with all these adults, and she sort of was at the stand, and then she looked down at me, and she said, oh, hello, that's all she, you know. I was kind of embarrassed. I said, oh, hi, you know. And then in the evening, when she was signing chapbooks, I gave her a poem of mine, and she gave me her card. A card with her phone number on it and said, call me anytime if you would like to. And of course, I never did. I was very awestruck. And she told me that if you want to be a writer, write. And that little sentence really changed my life. I understood at 13 that I was sort of hearing the voice of God, you know, and I started writing and keeping these journals and writing as if they were going to outlaw writing. And I had that voice of hers sort of ringing in my ear. In my own work, I try to revisit that advice, and I do that in writers' workshops and with students as well. We have to start moving our hand across the page, right? So we have the idea and the image, and the imagination begins to fire up, and then there's the physical work of moving the hand across the page. If you want to be a writer, write. So you're moving your hand physically across the page, and a lot of things happen then. You know, in sports, and there's been a lot of writing about sports, and I'm not a big sports guy, but I've been reading a lot about sports and writing. So in sports, you would say, let's go practice, right? But how many times do we hear writers say, I have to go practice writing? You know, I need an hour set apart to go practice or to take a walk and observe, right? So we sort of poo-poo these things, or we feel as if it doesn't take a lot of effort, that it sort of happens by magic, and either you're good or you're not, and that's the end of the story. So I think that looking at what she did in her writing, which was to study, to craft the work itself, to observe, and then obviously, because she was so prolific, to actually do the work of moving your hand across the page. So when I teach workshops, a lot of it has to do with that. And even with students, we might study a poem, but during the pre-writing of the poem, we may have a free write period, and I ask them to sort of move their hand across the page and continue to move the hand across the page. It does a couple of things, right? Gets rid of the editor in the brain, the person saying, or the voice saying, you know, you're terrible, you can't do this, stop doing it. And then the ideas start to really flow. And I think that's one of the biggest humps that I see when I'm working with adult writers and student writers, is that there's a lot of fear that it's not going to be the next best thing, even if we're in a workshop setting and we're just listening to bits and pieces of a first draft, right? And so working past that, doing the work, putting it down on paper, longhand. Yusef Komunyak, I studied with him, and he would always say, we're doing it longhand. We're not typing on a computer. So we're writing longhand. That kinetic energy begins, comes from the brain through the arm, and onto the page. And I think Gwendolyn Brooks embodies that in her work, definitely. So that's sort of where I align with her, and just a personal remembrance that she was so generous with her time. And so she, in her 60s, began visiting schools and prisons and libraries, and just was so generous of reaching out to people. So like, I'm a personal testament to that, having spoken with her very briefly. But that's part of it, that we're working with generosity of spirit here. And I think that's part and parcel of being a poet as well. I think it's part and parcel of being an artist as well. And I think if we're not focused on the other person, whether we're writing a poem and painting words with pictures, or we're in a workshop, if we're not focused on the other person or people in that experience, then I think we're sort of doing a disservice to the art. Right, I think that going forward with sort of a generous spirit is also part of the arts, or should be. And she embodied that as well.
I have no idea what I would do, Timothy, if I had someone who I admired told me to give them a call.
Yeah, it would be intimidating. Yeah.
I was dumbfounded. I was a teen, an early queen, and I was really, I thought, this woman, she's so nice, but I'm sure she doesn't really mean it. You know, it's the critic in your head that starts. It's not the, sure, I'll call you tomorrow. It's the critic that rises. Don't bother her, and who are you, and you're just a kid, and, you know, all that sort of thing. But it's a really interesting going into the schools, and I try to remember that as well when I go in, that what one kind word from an adult can do for a child, you know? One kind word from an adult can really shift a child's perception of the arts or humanity. I remember some guy came in 2019 and he told me to keep writing. You know, it doesn't need to be a long diatribe, but that can really change people's lives.
It really can. I know I'm a self-editor. Not only do I edit the podcast, but I edit everything. And even from everything from poetry, when I talk to someone, I'll always think about it like 3 or 4 times before I say something that comes out of my mouth, because I'm a troublemaker.
Yes.
But
Mary Carr, a poet and the memoirist, says, if you're not a good worrier, you might not be a good writer.
maybe that's good.
Memoir. So I thought, whew, I got off scot-free on that one. But I'm a worrier too, so... you're heading in the right direction, according to Mary Carr.
Well, that's hope for both of us, Stephanie.
Exactly. There we go.
Yeah.
So, Timothy, when is your workshop with the Atrocious Poets? What day is it on?
It is the 6th of April.
The 6th of April. And I believe people can register for the event on etherealconfections.com. Tickets are $30 a piece. Well, Timothy, I'm going to thank you for talking with us today.
Yes, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Absolutely, absolutely.